It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kerry Kaufman. In an era of rapidly changing demographics, is the boardroom doing enough to keep up? This hour, we're going to explore corporate diversity and what it might take to help more underrepresented voices climb to the top of the corporate ladder. How is your workplace helping underrepresented voices in your industry move into management? Or is it not doing that? What suggestions do you have? Are we telling your story here? What struggles have you faced as you tried to move up the corporate ladder? And what advice do you have for typically underrepresented people who'd like to be a CEO someday? What are the obstacles that remain? And should companies, big or small, be making diversity a priority? What's the best approach to making that happen? That's all fodder for our discussion this hour on The Morning Show. Here's how to get in touch. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email also works, ideas@wpr.org, and you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Hart Posen, an associate professor of management at the University of Wisconsin School of Business. He's an expert on corporate strategy and strategic decision making. Hart, welcome to The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me.
PepsiCo's CEO, Indra Nooyi, is leaving the company. She's a successful businesswoman by any measure. She's also one of the few racial minorities to lead a major company and one of only 24 women CEOs in the Fortune 500. By all measures, Indra Nooyi was a successful CEO at PepsiCo. CNN reports that sales grew 80% during her 12-year tenure, and yet many news reports about this announcement pointed out the fact that she is both a minority and a woman. What does that say about representation in corporate America, Hart?
Well, you know, when you see a number like 12 of the Fortune 500 CEOs are female, and then you recognize that once you couple that with what in America is a racial an ethnic minority, it's not surprising that the media has focused on this. At the same time, that it's recognizable that we need to comment on the fact that a woman CEO the CEO stepping down is female, I think indicates that while perhaps we're making a modicum of progress, progress has been remarkably slow.
According to data from last year, 7 out of 10 senior executives at Fortune 500 companies were white males. That data is only based on 16 companies, though, because they're the only ones who shared their demographic data. How did we get here? What accounts for this?
Well, you know, I think there are two parts of the comment you just made. One is, how did we get to a state of the world where only 16 firms are willing to report the demographic makeup of their executive ranks, right? I think this indicates because firms that are doing well are obviously going to be more likely to report that data. But I think the broader problem, you know, of why we see a dearth of female and non-white executives goes back a long, long time. And in some sense, I think we have to understand that the distribution of females and non-whites in top management is something that is based on decision making and practices and bias that has been around for a long time and will take time to change.
Nooyi's departure will leave just 24 women leading Fortune 500 companies, and that seems like an awfully low number. How do we account for that? And before you answer, I just want to point out that CNN Money says that just over a year ago there were 32 women leading Fortune 500 companies. That's more than a 20% drop in just over a year. What can we read into this, or should we read anything into it?
I personally don't read that much into that that drop in the last year. You're talking about small changes in small numbers. You know, the decision of five or six people to step down has a large change in percentage terms because the base number of female executives is so low. So I would be a little hesitant to suggest that that reflects a substantive change in corporate behavior.
And the other thing about Nuyi's departure is she was at PepsiCo for 12 years, which, as I understand it, is more than twice as long as the average CEO tenure. Any idea why she managed to be at the top of Pepsi for that long?
You know, there's a lot of variation in the length of executive tenures. I think by all accounts, she did a very good job, right? Two big changes she implemented while CEO of Pepsi. One was to sell off their restaurant division, which was KFC and Pizza Hut, I believe, primarily. And the second one was to move into healthier snacks. Now, along the way, there were some sort of branding and marketing hiccups, but I think in general, the transition she initiated is seen in hindsight as being quite successful.
Do we ask more of women in CEO positions than we do of men? Are there higher expectations, or are they just different? Is that an issue here?
You know, I think there are two issues, right? Do we ask more of, let's say, females in their career path in order for them to get into executive roles? And secondly, do we demand more of them when they are in those roles? The latter is a little bit hard to answer because there are so few female top executives. They're work and their outcomes are highly salient in the media. And going back to your earlier comment on, you know, why we're focusing on the fact that this is a female CEO stepping down. The issue of what do we demand from them along the way is, you know, I do believe that in their career paths, females have to be females that reach the top executive roles have to be more extraordinary than we would demand of a man. It is a harder path.
And the other thing here is, only three times in history, according to Catalyst, a nonprofit consulting and research firm on women in business, only three times in history has a female CEO replaced a retiring female CEO at a publicly traded company. So in other words, when a woman in leadership steps down, she's replaced by a man. I guess given what we've already talked about, that shouldn't be any big surprise.
That doesn't seem like a big surprise when the number of male CEOs so overwhelms the number of female CEOs.
And let's talk a little bit about racial diversity, because that's another part of this, particularly in the PepsiCo example. There are currently only a handful of people of color leading Fortune 500 companies. One specific example, a piece in Fortune earlier this year points out that right now there are only three black CEOs on the Fortune 500. That's the lowest number since 2002. Hart, what's your reaction here?
My reaction is that, you know, these numbers, both the numbers of African-American top executives, female top executives, are distasteful and disturbing. My take on why it remains the case, though, you know, if we think about what is the problem that has led to this sort of situation where we see women and minorities so underrepresented in the executive ranks, I think we have to think about individual human bias. And I think, you know, at least I'd like to believe that as it becomes more salient and particularly white men are thinking about it and trying to be cognizant of it, that is slowly changing. But I think we also have to think of subconscious bias. We have to think about homophily, this notion of birds of a feather that we're inherently attracted to others who are like us. And I also think we have to think about organizational processes that underlie a lot of sort of the early types of career decision making that move people sort of in the organization into a fast track. And I think that has been underappreciated and under-discussed.
We're talking about the lack of diversity in the corporate boardroom today with Hart Posen, Associate Professor of Management at the University of Wisconsin School of Business. He's an expert on corporate strategy and strategic decision making. And we're wondering what you think about this. What can be done? Is it a problem? Is it not a problem? What would you like to see happen here? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Again, that number, 800-642-1234. How important do you think it is, Hart, for any business, big or small, to be thinking about the issue of diversity in the corporate and executive ranks? And what are the consequences of not doing so?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this question a lot. For me, there are sort of two parts to why firms need to take this seriously, right? One important part is sort of what is equitable, what is morally correct. And I think that discrimination is a social ill that we need to fix. The other is that the research literature shows some evidence of positive performance implications from diversity. So there's both sort of this moral argument for why we should fix this. I think there's also this firm performance argument for why we should fix it. And I think both are important.
Well, the demographics of the United States, and we're probably this discussion is pretty much limited to the U.S. But the demographics of the United States are changing quite rapidly, and let's face it, white people are going to be a minority in the near term. What does that mean for corporations? How much do they really need to pay attention to this? And do you think they will?
Well, I think firms are increasingly paying attention to it, although if you look at the number that disclosed diversity in their executive ranks, that rather small number of the Fortune 500, the number is 16 or something like that, perhaps not enough of them are doing it. I think the other reason, you're absolutely right, right? Demographics are shifting and shifting rapidly in some parts of the country. And these corporate changes lag, right? Folks have to move up the organizational hierarchy. They have to be fast-tracked. They have to garner the necessary experience to move into the leadership ranks. And this takes years. And what that means is that firms, have to look forward a decade or two decades to ensure that their pipeline of talented and experienced people reflects the larger population on these important demographic characteristics.
So there's one thing here that this brings to mind, and it's a story I read is not necessarily directly related here, but maybe this is a way to get at making some of the changes that you'd like to see. And that is that there was a story that ran earlier this week or last week, I think, that a star athlete, in this case it was a swimmer, who was signing an endorsement deal with major companies, had what was called an inclusion clause in the endorsement contract. And that is the company that she was going to endorse had to agree to work on issues of diversity within their corporate structure, and that was important. And we've also heard from people in show business and other areas, okay, if we're going to work for your company, if we're going to endorse your company, then this is something that you need to do. You need to make an effort and demonstrate that that you can be inclusive in your hiring. Do you think that kind of thing is something that could lead to changes in the corporate boardroom?
I think if it spreads, it certainly can. You know, I think what you're getting at is the type of social movement that we see can drive rapid change. You know, most recently, obviously, the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter. These can really change organizations and societies' focus on these issues. Now, I think the athletes and others who endorse products of firms are one part of it, but I think customers as well, right? Us as customers of many of these companies, right? We can act collectively to influence decision making by saying we prefer to buy our products from a firm that takes diversity and inclusion seriously. And I think if the kinds of social movements that we've seen around Black Lives Matter or Me Too were to take hold in this area, I think it would certainly spur progress.
Well, and certainly we've seen the use of social media to ask sponsors, for example, not to support certain kinds of programs on television and radio. People have gotten into trouble for things they've said online or on television, on radio, in newspapers and magazines and so forth. And so there is some effort there, and we're seeing some effect. So maybe this could spread into the boardroom.
I do think. Let me just add one point. I think that it has to be more. You know, where you've seen real action is where it goes from. You know, I prefer to buy from companies that take diversity and inclusion seriously, to a much more organized movement, right, that can coordinate action across people, across geographies, in a way that makes it much more salient, right? When the board members and boards are over, still, you know, females account for 21% of board seats in S&P 500 firms. When they can see large organized action, that is quite different from sort of the anonymous action of customers or the action of just a few endorsers.
Okay. We're going to take a break for news. We'll come back and have more of our discussion with Hart Posen about diversity in the boardroom. How is your workplace helping underrepresented voices in your industry move into management? We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. We're going to continue our discussion of this topic in just a moment. First, we'll take a break for news. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. John Munson in for Kerry Kaufman. Kerry is back tomorrow. Diversity in the boardroom. That's what we're talking about today. How is your workplace helping underrepresented voices in your industry move into management, or is it not doing that? What would you like to see happen here? Are we telling your story? What struggles have you faced as you've tried to move up the corporate ladder? What advice do you have for typically underrepresented people who would like to climb to the level of CEO someday? And what are the big obstacles here? Should companies, big or small, make diversity a priority? And what's the best approach to making that happen? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Hart Posen, Associate Professor of Management at the University of Wisconsin School of Business. He's an expert on corporate strategy and strategic decision-making. Well, going back to something that we kind of touched on before the break, many corporations and businesses say that diversity is important to them. What there's less agreement on, however, is what works to actually make an organization more diverse. So, Where do we start on this issue? What about how recruiting is done?
You know, I think you're asking a very important question here, right? And the way I think about it is, what is the real problem, right? So when you ask, what should we do about it, if the problem is overt bias, we would do something very different than if it was some kind of subconscious bias or a sort of homophily, this notion of birds of a feather flock together, or if it's organizational processes where the bias is built into the decision-making process. And so what we do depends on what that problem is, right? For instance, if you think that the problem is you have males who perhaps subconsciously prefer to hire other males who are like them, and this notion of homophily is ingrained in human nature, then some of the things that you could do, and if they were in charge of that hiring decision, is you could change the makeup or structure of the hiring decision, right? You can change how resumes are screened. By changing the share of males and females in that decision-making roles, you can change the numbers of females who will at least be interviewed and talked to. You know, there's all kinds of interesting research that shows that the same CV with a male name rather than a female name, or an American-sounding name rather than a Chinese-sounding name, or a Caucasian-sounding name rather than an African-American-sounding name, get preferential treatment. And it's not 100% clear that it's overt bias that's the problem.
Well, and we often hear about what's called the good old boy network, and this goes back to the birds of a feather thing. There are a lot of business discussions that take place in private country clubs and private social clubs with that seek to limit their membership. Many of these still don't allow women to join or minorities. And how much of a problem is that still?
You know, I think that's a little hard to answer right now. Clearly, you know, women excluded from male-dominated country clubs and what have you is clearly declined rapidly over the last few decades. I don't think that doesn't mean that it's a problem in the following sense. Social networks are built up over a lifetime. So if you see and talk to a male executive, their social network, their set of contacts, their experience moving through the corporate ladder, up the corporate ladder, will be dominated by interactions with other males over the past 20, 30, 40 years. And so that is something that you cannot change simply by convincing that white male that he should be working harder to be fair to non-whites and to females. It's insufficient. We need to put in place decision-making processes, not just at the top, but decision-making processes that go down to the bottom and middle of the organization that function to bring females in, to move them into the fast-track roles that from which sort of executives tend to come because of the types of experiences those folks in those fast-track roles will have. It is not enough to say to a white male, you must change your behavior. We have to do something else. We have to change the decision-making processes of the organization.
It seems like we're seeing a really different picture in the political world right now. I mean, this is a really sharp contrast. We have more women and minorities than ever in our history running for office at all levels, from the local level all the way into national politics. Do you think corporate America could learn a thing or two from the political world?
on the one hand, yes, right, this is clearly a good thing that we're seeing, at least slowly, increases in diversity in the political realm. At the same time, decision-making there happens quite differently, right? In the political realm, while there's influence of sort of large organizations, the Democratic National Committee, for instance, or what have you, it has much more of a grassroots kind of feel to it, right? Mm-hmm. It is less organizational. And I think that's consistent with my claim that some of the changes that need to be made are not in the minds of individuals. Many individuals' minds would not demand, you know, would not push them towards a preference for white males. Yet the organizational processes in place in their organizations do this, and they don't even recognize that their processes are doing this. Those processes are less powerful in the political sphere.
We had a guest on this program last week who talked about how research shows that women in a lot of workplaces have adopted a survival strategy called intentional invisibility. They make themselves invisible in order to survive. That's not a strategy that's going to get you into the boardroom, is it?
That's not a strategy at all, right? That's not a strategy to... That is a strategy to survive, perhaps, but the folks that make it into the upper echelons of the organization tend to stand out in the organization from a fairly early period. You've got to be visible to be fast-tracked. You've got to be visible to be given the kinds of early important jobs through which you'll build the skills and capabilities that you'll need to sit in the boardroom to be in the C-suite. And so, yeah, I think invisibility is the wrong thing. That said, I think it's worth noting that there's a question of why they would feel that they need to be invisible.
Well, I can give you the answer to that, and that is that they get punished for behavior that is acceptable in men, but apparently not acceptable in women. How do we overcome that?
You know, and I think we have to ask: is this a problem of individual bias or organizational processes? Right. So, if that is an area of individual bias, men expect women to act in a particular way, and the way they need to act to move into the C-suite is quite different from that. They will certainly be organizationally punished. The challenge is that kind of bias or belief is often subconscious. We have, all of us, in our minds, subconsciously, beliefs about how others should act to fit their role. We certainly have to change that, right? You know, back to the old days where people used to dress their baby boys in blue and their baby girls in pink without thinking about it. Now we certainly think about it before we do something like that. I think that needs to be changed. At the same time, I think we need to put in place organizational processes that will look out for that, will redress those kinds of managerial errors that punish women for acting in the way that we would expect men to act if they wanted to move up fast. And you know, you asked the listeners to comment on what their organizations were doing. You know, I think even at the University of Wisconsin School of Business, we have an assistant dean of diversity whose job it is to not only help people recognize their overt and subconscious biases, but to think deeply about the way the school's administrative processes function and change those processes in a way that makes better decisions more fair decisions, more equitable decisions, more moral decisions.
We're in the last minute of the program, so a quick last question here. Are you optimistic we'll see more diverse rosters of CEOs in the coming decade?
I do remain quite optimistic. I think sort of that drop in the number of C-suite women this year is an anomaly. At the same time, I think we should expect the changes to be slow changes, right? We need to be sure to build a whole a cohort of capable and experienced women. We need to change the bottom of organizations to promote, to give experience to the women who will be in the boardroom and be in the C-suite and to be the CEO. And I think that will happen. I think the kinds of social movements we talked about earlier will make a difference. I think organizational attention to processes, not just conscious bias, is important. And okay. I think it can happen.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Hart, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Hart Posen is an associate professor of management at the University of Wisconsin School of Business and an expert on corporate strategy and strategic decision making. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.